15 to 20 million.
I am your future.
Isn't it about time for a change?
We are national leaders.
AmericanWorkersRadio.com.
You're listening to American Workers Radio, a national network promoting American-made products, with your host, Michael Blihash.
Well, welcome once again to another edition of American Workers Radio, broadcasting on 860 AM out of Philadelphia, but we do serve the entire tri-state area of southeastern Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and northern Delaware. Now, if you live outside the Philadelphia tri-state area, you can go to your phone, invite family and friends to tune in on the internet simply by going to AmericanWorkersRadio.com and click on the Listen Live link. Well, if you received our email announcement today about our broadcast, also send it to family members and friends and invite them to tune in. I want to take this opportunity, first of all, to say thank you to Mike Sessions, and he is working on the Go to app, which is for American Workers Radio. It's right on the front page of AmericanWorkersRadio.com. All you really have to do is go to the App Store, put in Buy American, look for American Workers Radio, download it, and boy, you'll become a growing part of our family. I want to tell you that we have a number of good people that tune in all the time on the internet and in our tri-state area. And this past week was very good as I went around to some community events on Saturday, two public events, and the people are talking about all that we are talking about on this broadcast, but most of all, they're going out and speaking up at the stores where they shop. And it's because a growing number of people are going out and supporting the Buy American Made campaign, talking about American Workers Radio. And as you know, everywhere I go, I give out our flyers inviting people to tune in, that we're having a little more of a positive result from our discussion. More businesses are considering coming back to America, where it's really our customers are living in America, so why not have the business in America? And they're also looking for ways to make it more profitable as they open their businesses right here in the USA. Our panel members today are Mark Andel, founder of the Made in America store, Larkin Connolly, East Coast Vice President of SCORE. Now, a new title, he is now a business advisor and SCORE advocate, but he was the vice president, and as that, he has an unbelievable amount of experience to share with us. And also Rich Loges, who will be joining us during the second part of today's broadcast. He is the principal of RJL Technology Integration, and our engineer is Henry Chaplinsky, and I'm Michael Blihash. Now that I did all the good stuff for the FCC, I can tell you that we also have with us today a great guest, James Stuber, who is the author of What If Things Were Made in America Again? And I think last week's show was a great broadcast. We had a little bit of time with Jim. Today we're going to spend a lot more time with him. He has a lot of key points to discuss with us and our panel members. And first of all, Jim, I'm going to ask you to give us a little history about yourself, and then I'm going to ask Larkin Connolly and Mark Andel to join in the discussion. Welcome, Jim Stuber. I can't thank you enough for coming back on the broadcast today. How's everything with you?
Oh, it's a beautiful spring day, as you know, here in Philadelphia, and I'm also just so delighted to be with you guys and be able to spend some time sharing some of this information with our listeners. So it's great to be here. As far as the background, Michael, where I'd like to start is just to say that, you know, my family all worked in the steel mills in Pittsburgh and areas of Ohio. On my father's side, they were immigrants. His father was an immigrant from Czechoslovakia. And by my mother's side, going back a long way. So pretty much everybody I knew worked in the steel mills. And so I saw that life up close. And even by the 1980s, it was bothering me a lot watching all those jobs go away, basically going to Japan and Korea at that time. Of course, now it's China. So that was the background that gives me, you know, so much of a passion for this subject. But also just the idea that, you know, a steelworker's son could live the American dream. And it was available to me. You know, I could go to Ivy League schools, go to law school, emerge without much debt, and really have that dream of a better life for our children. So that was the background. My first love was public policy, and I started out working on Capitol Hill, pursuing that as a legislative assistant to a congressman, and then went off to, I actually ran for Congress as well, because I thought perhaps I could actually do that job, having been kind of a right-hand man. But I guess my wife would say she's glad that that didn't work out, because it's a hard life. It would have been hard to raise four kids that way. So I went off into law and entrepreneurship, but this grabbed a hold of me a few years ago, and now I'm just delighted to have been able to put some of that background to work, digging out the facts of what's really going on, and happily with the realization that consumers could solve it.
Very well said, Jim. You are amazing. Tell us a little bit about the book.
Well, it started with, you know, they say people have their light bulb moments, and mine actually involved a light bulb. I took out a GE light bulb, and on it were just the GE logo and, in all caps, the word China. And just for some reason, you know how things will grab a hold of you. Seeing those two things together, the GE logo that stood for America and Thomas Edison, all that's great about the country, and the idea that they were making their light bulbs in China just really shouted out to me that, you know, Houston, we have a problem. Something is probably wrong. And so also coincided with a couple of events. I had been to the Scout store, and everything I bought for my son was made in China, Vietnam, and Bangladesh. I hadn't really noticed that before. I don't even think Scouts are legal in Vietnam and China. And we had had the chaplain from Coatesville Prison speaking to our church men's group. And I was thinking, you know, I'd volunteered in prisons, and I knew there's really never an excuse for committing a crime, but wouldn't it be easier to keep the young men in Coatesville straight if they had jobs they could aspire to that would support a family, and, you know, if they made anything there anymore? So that's really where this book came from. This grabbed a hold of me, and I said, look, I'd like to find out what's going on. Why does it seem that everything's made somewhere else, and is that really causing a problem? And if it is, what could we do about it? And so it just wouldn't let go of me, and I was off on nearly 3 years of research, the result being this book.
Well, Jim, you've impressed me with all that you've done. I'm going to turn the microphone over to Larkin Condley, who I know has several issues to discuss with you. Larkin.
Hey, good morning, Michael and Jim. I think Mark Andel is on, and Henry, good morning to all of our listeners. It's a very beautiful day in Florida. The heat is starting to show up, but on top of the heat, today is going to be kind of humid, unfortunately, so we're going to have to suffer through that, if that's what you call suffering. You know, funny enough, Jim, I didn't get a chance to say anything last week. But you and I are very much alike. I was born and raised in Highland Park section of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I went to Sacred Heart grade school. I went to Peabody High School, and then my junior year went off to military school in Wheeling. But I am a Pittsburgher through and through. I have not heard you say the word Don yet. I did not pick up from your dialect any of that infamous Pittsburghese. But my father also, my grandfather, my father's father, came over in 1905. My father was born 10 years later here in this country. My grandfather spoke brogue. That's the only thing I could call it. It was English, but it was more brogue than anything. And he insisted that his family, from his sons to his daughter to his grandchildren and to everybody around him, that they speak English. And very much the way everybody, every other dialect in, or every other language in Pittsburgh was treated. You're in America. Let's learn how to speak English. We don't quite carry that on our sleeve anymore. But at any rate, I'm an rabid Steeler fan, and we'll fight it. Wants to discuss that at any great length, including people from Buffalo. And I also am a Pirate and a Penguin fan. So Pittsburgh is my home. It will always be my home. And the steel mills, I don't know if you've been to Carnegie lately, but it's a sorry sight from, what it was back in the heyday. So if they bring mills back to America, it will not be, unfortunately, in Pittsburgh. But we have arisen as a technology center and are doing some great things out there. So I'm a very proud Pittsburgher, as I think I hear in your voice that you are. And I can't say enough about the wonderful city to bring up children and to be raised. And I can't say enough about the city of Pittsburgh.
The other thing we have in common, Larkin, is some South Florida experience. My father cleared out. He was living in Cleveland. We were living in Cleveland. He was working for a steel mill there, Republic Steel. And when I was 10, he moved us down to South Florida, to Pompano Beach. And I ended up going back there to West Palm Beach. And I do know that in South Florida, there's quite a Pittsburgh community who get together and do things like eat chipped ham.
Chipped off him. Yeah, absolutely. You're 100% right. I'm in North Florida in Jacksonville, unlike our compatriot who was in Fort Lauderdale. But they're everywhere. Pittsburgh fans, Pittsburgh lovers, Pittsburgh provincial people are absolutely everywhere in the country.
Not everywhere, Larkin.
Oh yes, they are.
No, they're not.
I'll take you to a handful of bars in Philadelphia that they speak nothing but Pittsburgh, and whatever. I'm not paid.
But I think a lot of that Pittsburgh ethic. I mean, it was really such a strong work ethic and family ethic there, and I think those are the two things I would carry away from there, but are also common in so many other communities around America.
Jim.
And it's a diverse city, that's all. It's very, very, very diverse. It believes in its neighborhood, and it believes very strongly in who you are and where you're from and family, as you say. I mean, it's all very cool stuff as far as I'm concerned.
And the only thing I would add is I really picked up on your grandfather insisting that everyone speak English. My father wrote a memoir about growing up in Mingo Junction, Ohio, this little steel town. And
oh, I know Mingo Junction. Wow, I can't believe it.
Well, it had Mingo three Junction. Hills, and one of them was Hunky Hill, which was all of the Eastern European immigrants. And that's where he lived, of course, and he and a couple of his friends went home and insisted that their family speak English, because they just had the good foresight to realize that that's the way it should be. So when my dad was 10 or 11, he and his friends were making sure that happened, and it obviously is the way to go. Everyone's proud of their heritage, but, we're all in this together, and we need to speak the same language. And so this family of immigrants all went on, to do good things, being school teachers or, you name it. The American dream was alive. And many went into the mills, for as long as they lasted, till we started sending them all offshore.
Jim, I want to ask you a question. How do you see the situation of getting things made in America again? What's the reaction that you got from the book with the title?
Well, I could say that, over these last couple of years, it's really, since I've been telling people what I was doing, I was really... in effect, was conducting kind of mini study groups or focus groups of people I would talk to. And I was delighted to say that three out of four of them said, well, what I was talking to them about was I explained that I was researching this, and that as I realized this, it was getting hard to find the American-made stuff, that I planned to put up a website that would connect them with the companies that were still making things here. And they could just go on that site and buy them. And at least 3 out of 4, maybe 4 out of 5 people said, well, let me know when that site's up because I would love to use it. That I find a general, you know, a very widespread recognition that the path we're on is not sustainable, and they really would like to make a different choice if they could. My hope, though, is that that if we can get out the information of the kind that I've got in this book, people will get a greater sense of urgency about it, so that it's no longer a nice to do, but really becomes a must do. And that's why I think your show is so great, because I think people are alert to this issue, but they don't yet realize how urgent it is.
Ed, you're absolutely right. And, you know, I want to tell you this, Jim, and I'm going to then turn to Mark, that I've learned through my weekly commentaries on the radio that I've been doing now over 12 years or so, that people in the news media don't want to get involved with a lot of our ideas, our discussions, because that's not where their bread and butter is coming from at this point. The advertisers have now taken over what goes on TV, what the people should see, and what they're going to support. This is a big, big problem. And that's why our campaign, the Buy American Made campaign, going out to the people, the regular, everyday American, begging them to go into the stores to pick up things, talk about what's happening, has been a big, big success. It's a success because they don't see it on the regular news media. A lot of the stations are just endlessly beating up on one another, but they don't beat up on the idea of what are we going to do to help ourselves. Their own families are in distress because they don't have a real future. A lot of the kids graduated from colleges with great sheepskins, but they have no place to go long term in the future. And that's what your book and our radio program and a person like Mark Andel's trying to put on the surface for people to see. And with that, I'm going to ask Mark Andel, come in on and be part of our conversation. Welcome, Mark.
How you doing, Jim? Thanks, Mike. Hello, Lark and Henry. I guess Rich is going to join us later. Jim, again, great book idea. Loved having you on last week. Appreciate this week. You, like Larkin, I'm from a steel family. My father worked at Bethlehem Steel, and like your father, worked at Republic Steel, but out of Buffalo. So a lot of steel mm-hmm. and his father's and, you know, his family and people. So I guess we all share that, you know, blue-collar, middle-class background and history, which is awesome. I do want to ask, number one, is your book out right now, and is it available now? And I believe my buyer, Rob Whalen, reached out to you.
Yes, indeed. I'm happy to say the book officially was out on April 25th. It's available on my website, which is miaa.us. That's for Made in America Again .us. There's a link there through to it, and with some good information, also some introductions from me and so on. It's available on Amazon, soon in Barnes and Noble, and I hope soon in your stores, Mark. And I'm about to respond. And just before we went on the air, I got confirmation from my printing company that all of the materials in the book were from America, so we can sell.
See what
it
I caused, Jim. Everybody gets
100% American made. All the paper, all the
century hour vendor package, and you know, Jim, when I was when I went 100%, I said that's our concept, that's our core value. I know everybody can't be 100%. We've got puzzles made at Buffalo, but the ink's from Canada. I have no problem with Canada, but I can't sell them in our store. Mm-hmm. I do want to ask you: did you get our care package then? With the movie, I believe a CD and a couple things. And did you have a chance to view any of it?
Yes, I'm very happy to say I received. Thank you so much for the CD, the Made in America movie. And it just was so well done of where it traced your story and the gal from New England.
Mary.
Who was making the jewelry that the Smithsonian decided could be better made in China for a while. Thank God they seem to have recovered their senses, and just very moving. And the thing that Carrie, you know, really gets me, Mark, and I just want to say hats off to you, is that you're another guy like me. You're just farther down the road who this idea got a hold of and wouldn't let go. And you just show that if one person with an idea will go and run with it, you don't know what will happen. And now we've got busloads of people coming into your store. I'm just delighted, at what you had the courage to risk to do that.
Well, thank you. And, you know, it's all of us. It's Mike with this show since, for years, and you yourself. And it's one team, and we all share a common fabric. I'd like to tell you a little background on that American-made movie. Clyde and Sonny Strickland were their philanthropist, and Clyde was a sharecrop farmer, came up real poor, tough life. Then in life, through construction, he had fallen 8 floors. A scaffold broke loose. His partner died. Clyde, they said he'd never walk again. He did walk. Then he met a guy named Hardy, gave him his first job. It became Hardy Restaurant, and Clyde has quite a story. I'll send you a book next, Clyde's mm-hmm. book. But Clyde put over $4 million with other investors, mostly himself, and it was a 3-year project, took 17 people. That wow. movie was, and he tells me every time I talk to him, I just talked to him Saturday, remember, that's not to make a dollar off of. That was the change, and it's now a curriculum in all Georgia schools, being taught from 8th grade to 12th grade. That was his idea to make it become a national curriculum and be taught in 960 Georgia schools. Clyde also has the first entrepreneur school that opened last year, and I just talked to him Saturday. Mike, we're going to get him on right before the end of the month because he started a new skilled trades tech school, kind of neat story. So quite a person, quite a team behind it. 3 years, and it hit theater in 2013, hit video mm-hmm. on demand. But the whole point really was he had a vision one day to show where America was after World War II, where we are today, and how people, consumers, just like you believe, Jim, that's why it's awesome when you say you realize the power of a consumer. They can change no matter what we talk about, no matter what beliefs, no matter what the circus on the news, which I'm starting to not listen to. People can change by demanding Made in America. Larkin supply chains can come back. Everything can happen. I believe 90% of our problems can be solved by giving families a way to provide for themselves through Made
in
America.
So true. So true. I mean, both points. The first being that creating and then deploying that demand is really the solution, the start of the solution. And then, as you say, the solution then is, you know, what happens when we bring those jobs back? Well, we take the slack out of the economy, wages can get up again, and people can support themselves again and be independent.
Well,
not
goes down
on a subsidy.
If I can just build on what Mark just said and extend a little bit of the conversation that we had last week, I asked you at the end of your book if you drew any conclusions, what it's going to take. What's the best approach to turning this untenable situation around? At that point, you said to check labels, which, quite frankly, didn't satisfy me as the whole approach to fixing this. But let's talk about that a little bit. What is the conclusion? What's the fix? Does the federal government lend a whole bunch of money to build the supply chain back? Do we take one industry at a time? What's the answer?
Well, when I said check labels, that's really just the first step. I think a very important second step that people can do today, you know, as soon as we get off the air, is to also do what you said, and that's go into the store and say, you know, I'm looking for a dog dish for my dog, and I want to make sure it's safe. Do you have any that are made in the USA, very politely? And or can you show me some of the things you do have made in the USA? You know, I like your store. I'd like to patronize you. And so that word starts getting back to the buyers. And eventually, what my hope is that the purchasing agents, the buyers, are saying, can you get us any of these things that are made in the USA? Because none of this stuff made in China is moving. We can't move it. So you've got to get out there and find us some that are made in America. And all of that is going to come from consumers who are either buying, if you're looking at 2 3x5 cars and one's made in China, one's made in the USA, and everybody's buying the set that's made in the USA, they'll stop giving shelf space to the stuff made in China. This is the kind of power that consumers have. And then the next thing is, this is checking the label on a big ticket item. So I did a study of how much spending could consumers bring home with the goal of, if we brought home we have a $700 billion trading goods deficit, and I identified $500 or $600 billion of that is consumer goods. And so the largest category is automobile. So consumers can do the equivalent of checking that label. The National Highway Transportation Safety Agency tells you at least whether it's U.S./Canadian content. It's not totally accurate. And there's a professor at American University has taken it a step further, and he uses a scoring system that includes whether it's an American-based company, where the profits are going to stay here, and he gives some extra points for that. And so you can know where the engine is made, the transition is made, and basically you're going to end up with a number, hopefully something north of 70% of U.S. content. And what a huge thing this is, what power you have when you're spending $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 for a car, and you can decide. There's a whole list of them that have zero U.S. content. Those are easy to knock off the list. And then you can look at the so-called Ford or Chevrolet that was made in Mexico. You can cross that one off the list. And what power that is that Americans can do if they just stop and take the time to do that. Or maybe a more intermediate level thing would be a friend of mine just bought large appliances, washer and dryer for his home. He made sure they were GE with at least 70% U.S. content. What a difference that is. So consumers, it sounds like just reading labels, you're not going to be able to do anything, but just by making these choices, consumers can have a huge impact.
And consumers do have a huge impact, Jim. When they go into the stores and speak up, those salespeople look at what you buy and what you decide to walk out the door with. You just mentioned washers. We bought a new washing machine maybe 6 months ago. And I'll tell you, I went to 3-4 stores, and every well-spoken salesman tried to take me down off the wall and tell me what's the difference about why the machine is made far and why am I so concerned about it. I said, because it's helping people maybe in your family keep a job, maybe a manufacturer, maybe a distributor, maybe an advertiser. I went down the list and the guy looked at me and he says, well, I see the point. But we did get a 100% made in America washer, a GE. So there are products out there. And at the store I went to and I bought it, and I'll tell you, Gerhardt's, the manager at the Boulevard store told me he has never seen more people interested in American made, asking the big questions like he has in the last 3 years. And that's a great compliment to the viewers of the various programs that are promoting American made, shows like ours and people who are on the internet. It means that people are looking out for one another, and that's, we're trying to be one big happy family in the USA.
So I think that the movements have to have, you know, more than one prong. Unfortunately, the prong that you suggest is a viable one, and I understand that. But that's steeped with a need to educate the consumer, to ask those questions, not only to ask those questions, but to understand what the consequences are when they don't buy American.
Jim, you know, so you know now, since you got sent our vendor package, I believe, correct? So you know our requirements to be in our store, the Made in America store?
Yes, I do. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you could see how thorough we are. And you know why I bring that up? Everybody can't be 100%. And I'm sure you're familiar with the Federal Trade Commission's rule. It has to be 50% domestic, and it can be 50% foreign to be called Made in America, which I never really agreed with. With our vendor package, so I've got these books with all three pages from every vendor of the 7,000 in our store. And then we police it. So if Jim changes the pages later, you don't care. Because I get asked all the time, you still doing that thing? And me and my brother-in-law, Rob, we laugh. You still doing that thing? I said, yeah, saving the country is a lot of work. We're going to be at this for a while, you know? But what you said with, you know, the amount it's made in America, I'd love to see. So I own General Welding and Fabricating. We're a fabricating manufacturing house. Our welding gases come. They tell me how much oxygen, how much argon, what percent CO2, and every gas mixture has that exactly on the tag. And that's what I always wanted on Made in America products, but thank God there is certificate of origin rules, right? Because we're becoming the household seal. I want my seal to stand for 100% Made in America, and that's where our store and stores come from.
Right.
So your book I can take for you in our store and stores, which you have 9. So not only our 7 brick and mortars, I'll take it and I'll apply it in our store and stores, you know, because I like you. You're part of the family now, so welcome aboard, right?
So to that end, Mark, you and I had a laughing exchange about the Made in America, the guy that's doing a Made in America certifications. My point was, I don't know enough about his approach, but wouldn't there be room for somebody to step in and say, okay, so it's made in America. Is it sourced in America? If it's genuinely made in America, it's made in America. If it's assembled in America, then that's a different thing.
Yes.
So can't we just examine different ways to certify products?
Yeah, you know, Larkin, it's funny, I forgot about your text, and that's a great point. Why I'm getting into stores, kidney drug stores, 75 in New York, 25 in Vermont, we're toying with some big ones, even Publix, Larkin. Why? They trust me. We got the integrity. We're true to it, and they know they can trust. They do not want the phone call, these places, because there's so much fraud going on. Even our own government, the fraud. They learned how to get around things and waivers and products that weren't made in America that are, and even New Balance had a shoe for our government, for the military, but then they got around it somehow, which they had four shoes developed, but our own government didn't buy it because they found a way around it. And, Jim, I think you'd agree, and our team knows that, you know, the shareholders, all my 486 privately owned vendors, hopefully 487, Jim, with you, thank you, you know, will be, they're all privately owned. They're mom and pops. Not one of them is publicly traded. Not one is publicly traded in the United States of America. Me and the movie crew, we had a lot of fun because they kept telling me I'm changing their movie. Now, I didn't know these people. What do you mean I'm changing their movie? Our story, what I was doing, kept changing them. Originally, Jim, in that movie, there was 18 manufacturers. It was all about American manufacturing. Well, later, after they met me and they met our movement and what our team had done, our family had done, we changed the movie, and they kept telling us, Mark, you changed their whole movie. And they wanted to make it a documentary with some inspiration. If you notice, it's inspirational. If metaphors baseball, it was a can-do. My boys, my twin boys, see it in school. They said, no, for a documentary, Dad, it was inspirational. It gives you hope at the end, right? And that's what we want more of. So a lot to be said, Larkin, with this certification, but people should know, and we want to continue to be consistent, educate, and raise awareness. And, Jim, thank you for your book because that's exactly the tools we need.
Well, yes, thank you so much. I really hope it's going to make a good contribution. That's my big hope.
You already have.
You guys have raised an important point on the country of origin labeling. One, I have three legs to the stool of my effort here, my movement, if you will. One is a nonprofit, 501c3, that will get the word out to educate people about this, you know, and continue the research that I started with my book. And the second leg is the one I mentioned of putting up a website. I'm calling it Altham, A-L-L-T-H-A-M, loosely speaking, for all things American made. Just kind of bring that idea up. But the third leg is a nonprofit advocacy organization. The thing I love about this is that consumers can do this without asking the government for a single thing, and neither do we need to ask for permission. They can't stop us, and we don't need their help. We can just go do it. But there is one thing that I would like to see, and that is clear country of origin labeling on goods. Because even with the labels we have, and there's four, five, six different laws that cover different categories of goods, it can be really hard to find that label. I just bought some furniture, or go into a Home Depot or a Lowe's, and they've got all this stuff set out, and you cannot tell where that garden furniture set is made. So I do plan to include in this effort legislation that would require clear country of origin labeling so that anytime anybody advertised something with a price and, you know, basic information, it would include a description of where that's made in compliance with our current laws. This would be a big step forward. So first of all, it gets the issue in front of people. Oh, yeah, it does matter where that's made. If you're looking at the price, you should be able to look at its origin. And secondly, of course, it would help assist people in making their buying decisions. So it is an area that I'd like to see, where I'd like to see some improvement.
We say 50-50 fair trade. When Japanese, Vietnamese, Chinese come to my store, they say this is common sense. This is what you do. You support the country you live in. I want to take back a piece of your country with me. This is common sense. It's not sexy enough. And, you know, even with Donald Trump and the new Washington administration, at least mentioning it, hire American, buy America, put America first, it's what you should do. Be self-sufficient so we can continue to take care of everyone around the world.
Absolutely. And when they say it's common sense, they mean it because it's what their countries did.
Yeah. Oh, they're so clear. They get it more than Americans do. I love the foreigners.
Yeah. But, I mean, they, in their countries, I noticed someone from Korea saying, you know, when he grew up there, it was a shameful thing to buy something that wasn't made in Korea.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I hear, Jim, all the time.
Yeah. So they kind of shake their heads about us.
Yeah.
You know, Jim, you're absolutely right. A lot of the visitors come, especially the media, the middle-aged and older visitors that come to historic Philadelphia. They tell us all kinds of stories, which is unbelievable. They say they go to our stores and they can't believe majority of the stuff is from where they're from, not from where we're, you know, visiting. We came to visit to do some shopping and things like this so that we could take it home where we can go over to our country and buy whatever you have here.
Mike, they love jeans, right? So they come, they assume Wrangler and Levi's are made here. They're not made here no more. So I got, you know, our Texas jeans, and they love it. Mm-hmm. They didn't know Levi's. You got to educate them. They didn't know. They said, what do you mean they're not made here?
You know, Jim, that with the fair trade labeling is very, very important, because what has happened over the last 8-9 years as people started to look at the labels and speak up, I noticed that this place of the origin of the product is getting smaller and smaller and smaller on the label. And that's a no-no.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to add an incident that really kind of cracked me up. I not only had a somebody make a comment about being in this country and not being able to find anything that was made in this country. She said, if I wanted to buy this, well, I'll wait till I get home. for a variety of reasons.
Why, one, carry it.
It's cheaper at home. And two, we wouldn't sell a lousy quality like this in my country.
Very interesting.
Good point, Larkin, because the Made in America logo, our logo that we use, was a brand that stood for quality, high quality, around the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Jim, we were talking about that for a while, that we have to get after the national leaders and the business leaders, those that are actually manufacturing 50% or whatever the rule is, to put some kind of red and white labeling on, a little flag or something to bring attention to it. I know even when I go into some of the hardware stores or whatever to pick up stuff, I'm seeing that a lot of non-traditional labels are coming into the marketplace. Not only are we seeing products that, even if you went to buy a Floodmaster or something, you may have another brand there that has a little flag on it, but it's not the brand name you would see generally advertised. So the fair label is something that's very important to try to push. I'd like to work with you on that.
Good. Yes, let's be sure and follow up on that. And that's where, you know, I did work in Washington for a while, and I'm happy to kind of bring that experience to bear on, you know, that kind of a legislative effort. Not to go too deep, but for our listeners, I think it is important to understand that Mark has set a really high standard with his 100% at the store. And that's so great because it does give you that trust factor. The Federal Trade Commission's standard for Made in America is a little bit below that. They call it all or virtually all is the standard they apply. And you can't even put a percentage on that because, you know, it kind of varies from product to product. It could go as low as even 70%. I know in the case of New Balance, they had a tiff with the FTC, and the FTC basically gave up and said, you know, if you've got a shoe that you are calling Made in America is 70%, well, we're not going to fight you on that. So it's a fuzzy standard. But I would say that at this point in time, you know, because we've gotten to the situation where we are, even going to a lower standard than that can be helpful. Because if something is being produced here in a factory here, and this is where you're really making the things, but some of the components are from overseas, boy, that beats the heck out of something that's just made in Korea. And so for my website, the standard I chose was that the principal assembly and the last place where this thing was changed into something, they call it substantial transformation. So to the layman, this is, you know, the place where it's really made has to be in the U.S. of more than 50% U.S. Content. So, you know, I I commend Mark with his pure standard, and hopefully we can get to that. So, but this is where I'm starting. And so if Joseph Abboud has got several hundred people making suits in New England, I'd much rather buy those suits, even if the cloth was imported, than the suit that was just imported entirely from China.
And that's where I think that standard assembled in America comes into play. And if a lot of the component parts, but you know, by percentage, it could be made and assembled in America, could be a level. And each level would mean something. And when you certify the product, the consumer clearly understands what's been made where.
So, of course, you know, in today's world, it can get pretty complicated. You know, if you just walk into the hardware store and you pick up an electric drill, and you know the battery is from Korea and the drill is from China, and you know, all of that stuff can be coming from different places. And it can get pretty complicated with respect to any one product, but I like the idea of a majority of U.S. origin and principal assembly in the U.S. I think it's a good place to start, and then you just head north from there to Mark's standard, which is, you know, 100% pure.
Right.
Which, Jim, is very, very difficult, and you know, I didn't know how difficult when I opened. Remember, I lost half my business to China, 70 employees, laid off 40. And it was just before the recession of 2010, you know. So very, very tough times for me in our industry. But that standard I set, and even my buddy said, what about 90, 10? And very, very hard. But I didn't know how hard it was until I got into it and then causing people. But then we started to cause people to change. You know, Channel Lock laughed at me, but then they came back. They changed the screws in some of their products so I could sell them. They didn't have a screwdriver. I picked on them. Well, 4 years later, they said, Rob, tell Mark we've got a screwdriver for them. But we started to make people change. Even there was a cowboy hat, they changed seven things. So it was neat to see the change, and I'm so glad I stuck to 100%. Because it made that statement that it's important. Not that everybody can, but I'm glad we are people that make change, because it's so hard to make change. Some of these laws, they're all made for that greedy. America got selfish, greedy, and lazy, I tell people. Now we've got to change. It's a 35-year mistake.
You know, Jim, I want to ask you something. Working in Washington, how much focus was on the minds of the elected officials to do something about bringing the jobs back, or at least stop them from leaving?
Well, the problem with that question is that I'm kind of old. So I was working on Capitol Hill from 1972 to 79. I was in Washington through 1983. So when I was on Capitol Hill, this issue hadn't surfaced. But when I was still in Washington, it had. And the thing I remember in particular, a personal vignette, is that there was a push out of Detroit for what was called domestic content requirements, that any car sold in the United States would have to have at least some percentage, 70% U.S. content. It would have been a great law. We should have passed it. And so this was, I would say, in the from the mid-70s to the mid-80s was when it really got traction and took off. But unfortunately, kind of the Pied Pipers of free trade have got everybody in a trance, so that even by 1992, 3, 4, when NAFTA was being debated, there was a very strong opposition to NAFTA coming out of the representatives of the manufacturing areas. But they were just selling this snake oil. And I've got a quote in my book from this guy, Bill Archer, from Texas, saying, we're going to raise up an American middle class, and they're going to be buying washing machines and automobiles from the United States. And you really have to wonder, like, what drugs someone would be on to believe something like that. But a majority of Congress was persuaded. So it's a mystery to me, to be honest with you, Michael. We had very little manufacturing in South Florida. We had a Motorola plant, something else, but we did have Pratt & Whitney was testing engines in West Palm Beach, out, you know, in the quiet areas where nobody lives. And we would go, the congressman I worked for and I would go in there at election time and shake hands in the cafeteria while everyone's going to work. And those were votes that no one would want to lose. And I have to say, I'm mystified by how these members of Congress could be voting for these free trade agreements all these years and gutting their districts. I do not understand it.
Agreed.
You're right.
And I've studied political science. You know, I've got 2 degrees in political science. And this is just a mystery to me, how they could be voting so much against their constituents' efforts. And the thing that just gives me great hope is that what you guys are reporting, that out there, you know, people are waking up. Because when the member of Congress hears this, or their opponent hears it and runs on this issue, I think we really do have an opportunity for change.
Jim, steel-toed middle-class America is waking up, you know, and the people that really built the country, and I think we all know the middle class has shrunk quite a bit and we need to rebuild it, but just so important that we keep talking like we are on the show today and keep it in front of people. And so many people stop me, thanks to you, Mark, it takes longer to shop now, because once you educate them and make them aware, they're peeking. They're like, holy cow, nothing's made in America. So very, very true, but again, congratulations on the book and your efforts, because with us all together, if we get on one track, we can make the change.
Jim, also with us today, we have Rich Logis, and he wants to say a few words. Rich.
Hey, guys. Good morning. And Jim, thanks for being back on. Good morning to you guys and our listeners. I was listening. Sorry I got on a little bit late here. You know, Jim, as someone who's going through the process of writing a book and publishing, I really commend you for doing this. This is not at all an easy endeavor. And my congratulations to you on your recent book release. So your website, again, for our listeners is miaa.us. So miaa.us. What I want to ask you, Jim, is where are our listeners going to see you next? Where are you going to be out there promoting and marketing this book so our listeners can check you out more?
Well, you know, I wish I could tell you, but it's kind of right now, because I'm only 2 weeks into this, it's on a day-to-day basis. So thank you for the question, Rich, but I can't say, you know, look for me on such and such news next Tuesday at 5. Cause,
hey, Jim, you feel like flying out to my big seven-year, seven-store event this Saturday? We have a book signing right in Alma, New York.
That'll be the answer, yes.
Rich.
Let's talk about that offline.
You're more than welcome. We get about 50 vendors.
I want to mention that there is a link right on the front page of AmericanWorkersRadio.com. You'll see picture of Jim Stuber there, along with a direct link to his book. Do check it out when the broadcast is done today. Yes, Larkin.
I was just going to say, you don't even have to fly to New York from where you are. It's a really, really pleasant drive up through the Adirondacks and all the way up to Buffalo. It's beautiful up there.
You know, it's funny. I would just so much love to do that. And, Mark, I hope that there will be a follow-on invitation. But I am fathering four children, and by the grace of God, our second child, Annie, has gotten interested in crew racing, and she's going to be in a two-person scull boat on Saturday in a huge regatta here on the Schuylkill River. So it'll be the only time I've seen a row this season. So.
Oh, very, very good.
But I'm just so delighted at that.
There'll be another one.
Brings me back to something that we were talking about earlier, which is our children, and what do we say to them, you know, and how we have college graduates now who just aren't making it. I saw a survey that really struck me in October of 2016. So this is very recent. And just the 30% of the respondents said that they were fearful they were going to lose their job in the next 6 months. That was up from 10% a year earlier. And 28% said they were afraid they wouldn't be able to pay their mortgage. That was up from 10%. And 39% said that their financial situation was causing them to lose sleep. So, you know, Americans are experiencing this harsh society we're creating by sending these jobs overseas. The Federal Reserve did a survey recently, and 47% of Americans said that if they had an emergency, they needed $400, they couldn't come up with it without borrowing it or selling some assets. So and then you look at the college graduates now. A large percentage of them are making, 41% are making less than $25,000 a year. And they took the trouble to go to college and go into debt. And that, you know, 2 days ago I saw a thing in the paper saying that over 50% of college graduates are receiving some kind of financial help from their parents. And half of the college grads who have jobs consider themselves underemployed. They're not using their degrees. So we're creating this society where, you know, people go to college, but they're not making it, we're sending the jobs to India or who knows where. And so what do we tell our children? You know, what have we created? But my point being that things really are not good. And when we read those top-line headlines about how low unemployment is and how well the stock market is doing, that's not a measure of how things are going in America.
Absolutely, Jim.
Yeah, the
Jim,
furthest thing in the world from it. You're 100% right. And that leads to a discussion, a rather lengthy discussion I would like to have with you for our listeners about the H-1B, but there's not enough time on our little clock on the wall today. But maybe the next time you return, we can talk about that. But when you and I had that conversation last week, I went out and did a little homework on the H-1B, and it's worthy of our discussion and consideration. But you're 100% yes. right. Education in this country is so broken, it's not funny.
Yeah, it's frightening. In fact, they reported that this year's graduating class, 50% have absolutely no nibble of a job. And that's very disappointing because many of these kids worked very hard to get that degree.
Mm-hmm.
They'll be working
mm-hmm.
down on the boardwalks mm-hmm. and at the arcades and all, but it's not mm-hmm. what they're looking to do. Many of them are into research and technology, and that will come back if we can bring some of these industries back. The cell phones, I mean, now the cell phones are being made all over the world, but not in America. Yet the cell phone started to really pick up and be widely circulated here in the USA by Texas Instrument. You look at mm-hmm. our clothes. I mean, majority of the people were called from overseas to come to America in the 1900s to be part of the Industrial Revolution. Now we have no jobs for the children and grandchildren of the people we called from overseas to be here in the USA. They have no jobs because the jobs are now being transported overseas. It's a killer.
Equally as important is what we're teaching our children in college, what they're graduating with. The situation is not quite as dire for STEM graduates
mm-hmm.
Who do find themselves competing with H-1B, and that's the horrible downside of that so many corporations are using the H-1B to do nothing short of cut their expenses and lower mm-hmm. their payroll costs. But, you know, it's the indictment of the education system in the country is what are these curriculums? What are you teaching our children? You are asking for $10,000 to $80,000 a year to teach children, and the question becomes net bottom line, what are you teaching them? How are you preparing them? How do they come out of college prepared to pay back this egregious debt when they aren't really educated to do that?
It's a huge problem. Yes.
Now, Jim, I'm gonna cut in here and ask you something, because this is a new venture for you, this book. I don't know how many people have called you on their broadcast to try to get the message out, but what are you doing in the next few weeks that you can come back so we can continue this conversation? I'd like to even bring along Sarah Blackwell to discuss what's been happening with the visas coming in and all the excuses that they're using. In fact, there is no group or society here in the USA that is trying to push against these visas coming here. Yet we have a tremendous amount of engineers, people ready to go into research and technology. They're being put out of jobs to bring in the people with the visas. It's all got to be put on the record. I can't get that message on many of the major news people, the Dom Giordanos and all, because they're focused on the political aspect of things. But we have to get our type of message, your type of book, Sarah Blackwell and Mark Andel and Larkin Connolly's story and Rich Loges, all of us talking as soon as possible. Again, let me know, Jim, when you are available. You have a standing invitation because you've seen it over the years and you have some solutions, and please do share those solutions with us.
Well, I would be delighted to have that be our next topic, the H-1Bs, and I'll just give you a hint. There's another category, the L-1B, that's even worse, and we'd be happy to pick you up at our next opportunity, Michael, next week's show or whenever you'd like to have
If you're
back.
Available next week, Larkin, are you ready?
Sure, and I'll tell you what, you bring up the L-1. You know what? These things fly through Congress.
And you know what, Larkin, I want to add just one thing. Most of our listeners, most of the American people don't know about these visas.
That's right.
They don't know what the hell is going on. Jim, can we depend on you being with us next week to continue this conversation?
Yes, indeed. I look forward to it very much.
Thank you very much to Jim Stuber. And I know that Mark Andel's having a very big celebration at his store this Saturday as he celebrates Armed Forces Day from 10 to 4. And he's going to have a big party over there with Ricky Lee and lots of food vendors. It's called his 777. That's a lucky number. 7 years, 7 stores, 7,000 products. Mark, you have influenced so many people. I want to wish you good luck as you celebrate your 777 this Saturday.
Thank you.
And we'll be talking more about that. I want to thank Rich Logis, who has been with us briefly. Rich, get all your questions out for next week. Larkin, we already know who our guest will be. And Jim, you've been an unbelievable guest. We learned a lot from you, and at least we know that there are more and more people coming on board with our campaign to get people motivated to buy again. Thank you, Larkin Connolly, Rich Logis, Mark Andel, and of course our guest, Jim Stuber. I'm Michael Blihash. Our engineer is Henry Chaplinsky. Until this Saturday at 11 or next Wednesday at 11 right here on 860, I wish you and yours the very best. We will have a rebroadcast of today's program up on the internet in about 2 hours. It'll be emailed out. Kindly email it to family and friends. Thanks, guys, for all of your help.
All right, Jim, get them books to me. I'll say good things about you Saturday.
Thank you, Mark.